More information is available at limelson.org.
Now you don't have to wait to hear Democracy Now. You don't have to wait till 9 a.m., I should say. You can hear it every morning at 8 a.m. on our HD3 channel, The Source. You can hear it online at WNF.org/listen. That's Democracy Now! Weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on WNF's The Source and 9 a.m. on our main channel. And it's replayed on The Source at 5 p.m. every weekday afternoon.
An animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Jan Creamer, president and co-founder of Animal Defenders International, or ADI, which was launched in 1990, maintains offices in Los Angeles, London, and Bogota, and specializes in educational efforts and campaigns internationally that tend to focus on animals and entertainment and other realms. In that capacity, Creamer and ADI were in the media spotlight in Washington, D.C. last week, as members of a coalition of some 20 notable animal organizations that stand as staunch supporters of the Traveling Exotic Animal and Public Safety Act, or TEPSPA, a bipartisan federal bill introduced to Congress last Tuesday, which seeks to end the use of wild and exotic animals in circuses and other performing entities that travel across the U.S. We'll find out more about TEPSPA and more about ADI when I speak with Jan Creamer in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll speak with Dr. Lincoln Parks, a retired veterinarian who is certainly not retired from his lifelong enterprise building custom-made carts for paralyzed animals, a task he's undertaken for more than 60 years. Dr. Parks is 92 years old, and I look forward to speaking with him a bit later here on Talking Animals. Before that, though, I want to remind you that WNF Summer Fun Drive is just around the corner, and I'd like to urge you to consider making an early pledge to support Talking Animals and me if you appreciate the work we do, the interviews we conduct with local, regional, national, and international figures. Please keep Talking Animals going with an early pledge, which you can arrange by emailing me at duncan@wmnf.org, or simply drop something in the Talking Animals tip jar, which you can find on wmnf.org. Look for Talking Animals on the broadcast schedule. Click on that portion, and then our tip jar will appear at the top of the Talking Animals page. Any early donation of any amount will be greatly appreciated. We always just need a bit of a head start to make what always is sort of a towering goal for an hour-long show. So thanks for anything you can do to help us in that way. Lastly, a quick programming note. Later today, I'll be back on the air when I fill in for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music from 2 to 4 p.m. today, right here on WMNF. Right now, though, let's get to Jan with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Jan Creamer on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
My pleasure. It's great to be here, and especially to be talking about TEPSPA.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that a little later on, but, of course, want to discuss that and just generally ADI's work and a little bit of its history and mission. But I always think it's useful to ask leaders of organizations like yours about their history to get a sense of an origin story. So let's first take a look way back. What did animals mean to you as a kid? What role did animals play in your family growing up?
We always had pets in the family, and I always loved animals. But I think for me, the life-changing moment, you know, you grow up and you start to have a life plan and you get to know what you want to do. But when someone, it was in the mid-1970s, someone gave me a flyer in the street about animals being used in experiments, and beagle dogs were being used for smoking experiments. And the issue was in the news. A journalist had got into a lab and taken photographs and released the story. And that was really the change for me. It just seemed so much more important than anything else I could do would be to work to save animals.
And why do you think, it sounds like you grew up with pets and stuff, as many of us do, but why do you think that particular leaflet and the information contained therein hit you so hard?
I think I was so horrified that anyone would do something like that to an innocent animal, a being that can't speak for themselves and can't protest, and certainly with those kind of beagle dogs, especially because they're gentle and friendly and obedient, all of their good qualities were being used against them. And I think, like a lot of people, the idea that you can just take another thinking, feeling, sentient being and use them like a tool, use them for your own purposes and then just kill them, I was just so horrified. And then, of course, I started to find out in other industries what we do to animals, and it just became something that I had to do. I have the best job in the world. I don't mind admitting that to everyone. I just love what I do. I love it when we save animals and we achieve things for animals. At the moment, we have 21 lions and tigers in Guatemala. They've just banned animal circuses, and we've gone back to take the animals from the circuses, and we're taking them to our sanctuary in South Africa. What's not to love with that? I'm very lucky.
Yeah. Well, just to back up a little bit. So when that leaflet was handed to you and you were sort of just outraged and horrified by the information about the beagles, was that sort of in some way, clearly it was a light bulb moment, but was it also the point at which you started thinking, hey, I need to take some action. I need to, maybe then you weren't necessarily thinking that would be something as a profession, but that at that moment inspired you to say, hey, I'm going to do something about this. I'm just so upset about this news about the beagles and the smoking experiments. I'm going to move forward and take action.
Absolutely, Duncan. The first thing I did was contact the local organization, a voluntary group that worked for the organization that published the leaflet. I joined the local group. I started campaigning, going out doing street tabling and organizing events and going to demonstrations. And in those days, that organization was the National Anti-Vivisection Society of the UK, the world's first anti-vivisection group. And had been going for many years, and was I got involved in lots of their campaigns. Eventually, I joined them as their magazine editor and a school speaker. One of the things we did was go around and give presentations to schools about what happened to animals. And often we would have debates with the opposition, and it grew that way. It was just such rewarding work.
And so it sounds like instead of having to bump into the leaflet about the beagles or whatever the topic at hand might be at that point, like you did, the idea was taking that information to schoolrooms and say, hey, here's kind of the information that you need to know. And we have kind of a captive audience, as it were, to present it to. And so the educational efforts there alongside whatever was going on with the magazine was probably a great source of outreach.
Absolutely. I think education and outreach, as everyone involved in campaigning knows, that if we're going to change people's minds, we need to talk to them about the issue, present the issue to them, whether it's at work, whether it's at school, or whether it's handing out something in the street or going to a demonstration or coming on to shows like this, so that people can understand what's actually happening to animals, which is always behind closed doors. It's always, you know, animal abuse happens in secret. They don't do it in public if they can avoid it. And then once people know and you give them the facts, that's when people start to change their minds and they start to participate in what's happening in the world.
Yeah. So you mentioned, if I understood you correctly, Jan, that the organization was then known as the National Anti-Vivisection Society of the UK. Does that mean it's changed its name subsequently?
In part, yes. That organization now works just in the UK, but internationally, that organization is now Animal Defenders International.
Ah, I see. So it evolved into...
It evolved.
Yeah, into your organization. So,
yeah.
Okay, so that's, that sort of makes sense in a way, given that what you've already told us about your story and your kind of narrative thus far. So, okay. Well, just in case people might just be tuning in, let me let them know this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Jan Creamer, president and co-founder of Animal Defenders International. If you'd like to ask Jan a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So Len, let me see if I have the narrative right. So the Anti-Vivisection Society of the UK evolved into ADI, and then did that sort of constitute the launch then of ADI at that point?
That's right. Yes, Duncan. So we launched ADI in 1990, and The reason for that was we had done a lot of good work on, we also fund replacement techniques. We fund scientists who are conducting scientific and medical research without animals. But something that happened really in the late 80s and 90s was an enormous surge of awareness for people about animal and environmental issues. All of the connections were there between the way we treat the planet, destruction of the environment, global warming, all of those kind of things, as well as what we were doing to animals. All of those issues were related. You know, if you look at factory farming, how it pollutes and destroys the environment, and then if you look at what's happening to the animals in there. And it's really a position that is an attitude and a policy that governments have and that people have towards animals and the environment. And so that's why we felt it was important to bring all that together. And as Animal Defenders International, we cover all of the issues on animals and the environment. And the circus campaign became so important because it's like a first step to awaken people and alert them to what's happening to animals. And we find with the circus campaign that even people who may not be aware of animal issues and don't think of themselves as an animal campaigner, but they can look at that issue and say, actually, no, that's wrong. We should not be abusing animals just for a few minutes of entertainment. And that's really how we get people starting thinking about that, and then they start to see the wider issues.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in the days of Ringling, people would, of course, here and so many other places do protests. And of course, people were always, those protesters were always mindful of being super polite and respectful in approaching people who were on their way into the circus. But very commonly, the experience was you would show people images, or if you were set up for it, video of what really went on, and certainly especially the training that went on to get those tigers to jump through those rings of fire, or to get the elephants to dance or sit up or whatever. And, you know, in some cases people had their tickets and their family was all set up and they had, you know, sitters at home for other kids or whatever. So they weren't about to necessarily bail then, but sometimes they did bail then and just said, you know what, now knowing what I know, I can't even go in, even though the show starts in 10 minutes. And at worst, it seems like many people would say, well, I've got too much invested this time around, but I'm never coming back. So I think that's right, that often started that process, and then people were more open to learning about other things that were often equally egregious.
Absolutely. It's about being informed, isn't it? And,
yeah.
You know, all of us, sometime in our lives, we start out and you just accept the things that, you know, you accept things like animals in shows. You don't really know about animal experiments, and you don't really know about the use of animals in farming and the way they're abused and all of those things. You grow up being part of that society and culture, and you accept it. And it's only really when you become informed, and like you said earlier, there's a light bulb goes on, and you realize, actually, I don't approve of that. That's not the kind of world I want to live in, where, you know, other species who live on our planet, our neighbors, are used and abused in that way for human gain often and human greed. And that's that moment that people get to once they have some information about what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, I think, and so much of it is with that awareness or information, trying to overcome what is often sort of a family culture. Hey, we always went to the circus growing up, so then I'm taking my kids to the circus. And there's just never any pause to sort of reflect on that unless that information is presented, and again, presented in a non-shrill, reasonable way where people could actually take it in and not feel alienated by it.
Absolutely, and with something like the circus, you know, and as you say, every family says that, you know, we took our children to the circus, and we enjoyed it as children. We'd like our children to have that experience, and then we just have to educate them and give them a logical picture of what's happening behind the scenes. Wild animals, all animals, don't particularly want to perform to entertain us. It's not something they want to do. It's not in their nature. They want to live their own lives, not the life that the circus presenters give them. And I think that's one of the particular things about circus shows and certainly the use of animals in entertainment, because if you think about the show itself, when the trainer and presenter, when they're presenting the animals, they give the impression that the animals are enjoying the show. And that's the whole point of the glitz and the glamour and the showmanship with the circuses. It's all very deceptive. It gives you the idea that it's a nice, gentle show, that presenter has a relationship with the animals. They do things, you know, when they kiss and cuddle the animals and they put their arms around the animals. They give the impression that the animal is enjoying that. They're not.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, they've been kicked and whipped and beaten and pushed into that ring. They're terrified of that trainer. And because we can't recognize it on their faces, we may not look and see those fear patterns that they're demonstrating. You know, unless you know they're there, unless you know what to look for, you're not going to know. And I think that's what horrifies most people about circus performances. And many, many times people have said to me, I had no idea. I don't want to take my children to a show where behind the scenes the animals have been beaten and abused. And I think that's where they draw that line. You get that red line of, well, actually, that's not acceptable. I don't want to see animals suffer for that few minutes of just entertainment.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of follow-up questions about that, Jan. But meanwhile, as a measure of kind of the importance of what we're talking about and sometimes the timeliness of it, one of the emails that just came in says, Florida Voices for Animals just found out there's going to be a petting zoo and circus with exotic animals at the Oldsmar Flea Market on Tampa Road and Racetrack Road this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and asking listeners to go to the Florida Voices for Animals Facebook page for information in preparation to stage some protests kind of quickly, hastily assembled, but need people to sort of help out with that. So we urge people to check out the Florida Voices for Animals Facebook page to help out in the exact kind of action that we're talking about with Jan Creamer from Animal Defenders International. So with that in mind, Jan, I mean, one thing, I'm sure a lot of people who don't pay as close attention to some of these sorts of things as you do, or maybe even as I do, think, well, Ringling suspended the circus a few years ago. So at least in the U.S., what is the concern as much about circus, and why do we need some kind of legislation that would deal with that? So maybe you could speak to other kinds of circuses that obviously don't have the profile that Ringling did, but that are still, going strong, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, there are still a lot of other circuses in the U.S., and it's still around 300 animals. So there's a lot of work still to be done, and also those pop-up type performances like the one that you've just mentioned that Florida Voices for Animals are getting people to protest against. These animals tend to be hired out show to show, and so you can see those animals possibly in a traveling circus or in another kind of show or in a festival. All kinds of events where they can get a booking for those animals for people to go and see them. So it is important to have a federal bill. Although we've got 92 jurisdictions across about 35 states in the U.S. Have all taken action and banned wild animal circus shows, we do need to do this as a federal bill. We've got some bans, statewide bans in New Jersey and Hawaii, and states considering bans are California, Colorado, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. So this is a growing movement. This is where members of the public have educated their elected representatives and told them that this isn't acceptable. This is not what they want to see happening in their town or their city or their state, and they want to see an end to this suffering. That's a very, very good movement. We've got momentum now. It's really moving across the U.S. So it is a good time to have a federal bill. There are lots of animals who are still suffering in circuses, and only people taking action will actually make a difference.
So with that in mind, Jan, maybe you could describe in some detail what the Traveling Exotic Animal and Public Safety Protection Act, or TEPSPA, does and what how that would change the federal kind of landscape in this way.
Well, TEPSPA, Traveling Exotic Animal Protection and Public Safety Act, is a federal ban. And it will outlaw the use of wild and exotic animals throughout the United States. The thing that it highlights for people is the suffering of the animals. So, given the constant travel and the temporary nature of circuses, they can't provide those animals with the facilities they need to keep them healthy and happy. The cages and the trucks and the enclosures that they build, they all have to be small and lightweight and collapsible. So those animals are kept in very small spaces for very long periods of time. And the abnormal behaviors that you see in those circus animals, the rocking and swaying and constantly bobbing their heads and just acting in a way that most members of the public can look at that animal and say, actually, there's something wrong with that animal. That's the stress of being in such close confinement with bare bars, bare balls. There's nothing to interest them. You know, the whole, every species on Earth is there created to interact with its environment. So we need that stimulus. We've evolved to have that stimulus to interact with our environment. We need to use our brains, have things interest us. That's the kind of thing that those animals are deprived of. And it's the kind of thing which we know if we do it to a human, it causes psychological damage. That's exactly what's happening to those animals and all, a whole range of species. I mean, obviously, dogs, cats, domestic species also suffer in circuses. They all get abused behind the scene. But what we've seen with the wild animals is that the violence used against them is egregious. It's extreme because the handlers are frightened of them. They're large and dangerous animals. They can be unpredictable. They have escaped. You know, there have been stampedes. Members of the public have been injured. And this is worldwide data. This happens in the US and everywhere else with these animals. They're kept in unsafe facilities, temporary, lightweight facilities, and they're put under extreme stress. And those animals, some of them, eventually will just click, they'll just flip and they'll just go crazy. And who can blame them when they're constantly abused? And so it's all of those elements of what's happening in circuses that the members of Congress will be getting information about now so that they can discuss TSPA and why it's important not only to protect the animals, but also for public safety.
Yeah, well, that reminds me, in the days where Ringling was touring, and they would always have an engagement of some length in Tampa, so I would always do a show sort of tied to that and change it from year to year in terms of who I would speak to, and sometimes it would be previous Ringling elephant handlers. And one time I did a panel discussion with various advocates and experts, and including on that panel Stephen Payne, who for many, many years was the Ringling / Feld Entertainment spokesman. And so we were talking about some of these very same things that you just mentioned, and the animals swaying in that sort of way that only when they're in complete distress do they do. And, of course, he tried to suggest that the animals were dancing and that they were just, that it was just they were having such a lovely time that they were actually dancing. So that didn't go too far amongst the panel that I had convened, but I just thought it's just a measure of how brazen, at least back in those days, the Ringling folks were. But so Jan, what... I mean, the U.S., in terms of this TSPA bill, I mean, isn't exactly at the forefront of this kind of legislation. I mean, as you noted, some states have done so, New Jersey, Hawaii, and others are certainly considering it. But, I mean, a lot of countries already have that kind of legislation in place. Why do you think the U.S. is so far behind?
Well, yes, as you say, it's 45 countries around the world have now taken action. And I mentioned earlier in Guatemala, they've passed their ban, and we're now rescuing the animals from the circuses. And we did the same in Bolivia and Peru and Colombia. And it is a lot of countries are way ahead of the U.S. and also of the U.K., and it's almost that, you know, all of these countries, 45 of them, have looked at the evidence, and it's absolutely clear to them that the animals are suffering and that public safety is at risk. And the only logical, sensible thing to do in these circumstances, because of the temporary accommodation and the constant travel, the only thing to do is to end the use of wild animals or all animals in circuses. Bolivia, for example, decided that it was all unacceptable, and they banned all animals from circuses. I think in the U.S. And the U.K., we have found the U.K. has just now introduced a government bill, and it's in committee. But they take much longer. It's as if we are, the democracies we have just have slowed everything down. And I think it's the system. It's the legal and political system. It just takes so long to take action when something is urgent. And it's something we've come to accept, you know. It's been about 10 years of the Teep Spur reintroduction and talking to members of Congress, and we've reintroduced it four or five times now. But that is not unusual, and I think that although it takes a long time in the U.S., we have to remember that it is similar in other countries. It can be 7 years, it can be 10 years. In the U.K., it was 20 years. So that's even worse.
Wow.
I think we have to be in it for the long haul, and I think that's the important thing for campaigners to understand, that these things have been happening to animals for hundreds of years. We're not going to overturn it overnight. As much as we would love to see the suffering stop now, we have to get into the fight, and be in it for the long haul. However long it takes, we keep pushing until it's done.
Yeah. Well, a couple things about that. First, let me just remind folks, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Jan Creamer, president and co-founder of Animal Defenders International. We're discussing TEPSPA, the Traveling Exotic Animal and Public Safety Protection Act, a federal bill that was reintroduced to Congress last week. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Jan a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at WMNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. So you noted that these things do take a while in everywhere, not just in the U.S., and that that the bill that was presented last week has actually been introduced and reintroduced a number of times over the years. Is there, besides just the machinery of legislation kind of churning slowly, are there other obstacles? I mean, again, in a previous era, I think I know that Ringling Brothers Feld spent a lot of money and had pretty high-priced lobbyists that were working against this exact kind of legislation. What are the sort of chief obstacles these days, since they're not really, you know, in that fight anymore?
I think the obstacle is now still to push more on education. I think shows like this, discussions like this, are going to help to make people realize what's actually happening to the animals. I think our chief obstacle is that certainly with animals and entertainment is that what people are seeing, whether it's a circus show or another type of live animal show, or whether it's seeing animals in movies or in other performances, what you see is something that looks nice and looks comforting and looks like the animal's enjoying themselves. And I think that's one of the biggest shocks that we give people, is to say, well, you know, behind that show, that performance you're seeing there, behind that animal has been shut in a tiny cage. It's psychologically damaged, deprived, and beaten. And that's what's done to give you the show that you've just seen. And I think that's what we have to keep pressing with people and with children. You know, we get the biggest, quickest response from children, because children naturally have an affinity for animals, and they don't like to see animals suffer. It's something that that they see straight away. And if you talk to children about it, obviously in the right way, you know, with kindness and be gentle, and you don't terrorize the children, giving them the full horror stories. But we find you talk to children about it, and straight away they say, okay, I'm never going to the circus again. And that's the most important thing we can do, is talk to families and children and educate them.
So at this point, with all that in mind, Jan, what's your level of optimism about TEPSPA passing this time around?
I don't necessarily expect it to pass this time around because it's not at that stage. But what we do have now is a lot of momentum. And that's really all of these years we've been working for is been to gain the momentum. And it's why it's been important to get bands in local towns and cities because you can get straight to the public there. It's something that's happening in their local area when they see the circus come, and you can educate them right there. I think the state bands have also now given us a lot of momentum. And to get Teepspa through, we need to get about 100, 150 co-sponsors. People need to talk to their representative in their district office is the best place. And what a lot of people don't understand is that actually members of Congress like people coming to see them. Writing to them and calling them is good. Emails are very good. People can come onto our website and click on a link there to write to their member of Congress. But best of all is to call them and make an appointment to go and see them in their district office. Take a group of family, friends with you. Talk to them about animals in circuses and ask them to be a co-sponsor. And on the email system that we have on our website, people can send their member of Congress an email. And even if they've already signed as a co-sponsor, they'll get a polite email saying, I know you've signed. Thank you very much. We really appreciate what you're doing. So it's a very smooth system. And absolutely, I would recommend go and see them, talk to them. We've got 16 now since the launch, and what we're looking for is about 100 to 150 co-sponsors. That will really set us up for the next Congress where we're much more likely to get Teepspa through. So it's a long game.
Yeah.
Let's get into it now.
Yeah, it really does sound like the big view, because it sounds like you're already obviously hopeful but realistic that this time around it's not going to probably quite get there. But as you build the list of co-sponsors and awareness and continue to build on the already existing momentum, that it sounds like you feel like by the next time around you might really be in a position to get this passed.
We really think so, Duncan. It feels like it has momentum. You know when a campaign starts to get that real momentum, and that's what it's feeling like now.
Yeah. Well, we're just in our final couple minutes or so, Jan. So let me ask you a couple other questions. I mean, first of all, just one that's kind of amused me. So if I'm not mistaken, these days the ADI locations are London. I mean, there's sort of like one of these is not like the others element, it seems to me. There's London, there's Los Angeles, and then Bogota. So, maybe you could explain how, you know, the first two make perfect sense. Bogota maybe wouldn't be quite as predictable.
Absolutely. Well, it's evolved. ADI has been evolving in that way. And in fact, very early successes close to the US, which has been part of what we wanted to do. But our early successes on the circus campaign have been in Latin America, and we did an undercover investigation, a 2-year undercover investigation of animals in circuses in across Latin America, different countries, and we released the investigation material in, I think it was about 5 countries at the same time, and showed people what was happening to the animals behind the scenes. And the public were horrified. People never imagined that they were taking their children to shows where animals were abused. And we got bans on animal circuses in Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, Ecuador, and a couple of other countries. And as I said, now we're in Guatemala, and of course there's been a ban in Mexico. There's been a ban in Costa Rica for many years. There are many, many countries now. And so actually for us, Latin America has been central to our campaign around the world. We also have an office in Peru, and we have just opened a wildlife sanctuary in South Africa. One of the problems for governments, once they ban animal circuses, the first thing they ask us is, okay, what are we going to do about the animals?
Sure.
And in the US, it's going to be, we have an enormous animal protection movement, and with lots of financing, so it's going to be very easy to relocate those 300 animals. But other countries don't have that kind of infrastructure. And normally in our rescues, it's large numbers of animals. You know, we took 25 lions from Bolivia and brought them to the U.S. We brought a tiger from Peru to the U.S. We took 33 lions to South Africa previously. And we've got 18 lions and tigers in Guatemala. So it's always large numbers.
Yeah.
And that's very hard for sanctuaries to suddenly absorb.
Right.
We have animals in sanctuaries all around the world. So we decided this time, well, we'll just have to build a sanctuary for the animals in South Africa so that we always have that capacity.
Sure.
To take more. We've got 27 lions there right now. And as I say, I hope in August or September this year, we'll be taking the 18 tigers and lions to South Africa. And three tigers will be coming here to the U.S., to Florida, actually, to Big Cat Sanctuary.
Oh, yeah. Big Cat Rescue.
Big Cat Rescue.
Yeah, great. And earlier when you were mentioning about ways people could reach their congressional reps, I meant to note that, although I think there's multiple websites, I think the fundamental one, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jan, is ad-international.org.
That's it. That's correct. Yes, okay. ad-international.org. And you can click there on the Cheats for campaign to email your member of Congress. And then what I would do, what I would urge people to do, is send them an email and follow up with a phone call and see when they're next in their district office and go see them. They'll love to talk to you. They want to hear about the things that you care about because, you know, you're a voter. They want to hear from you and talk to them about TEEPSPA, and if they've already signed, ask them whether they can bring any more co-sponsors. Can they speak to their colleagues in Congress, and can they bring more co-sponsors to TEEPSPA? And then thank them. Thank them for helping us.
Sure. And again, it's just so effective, as you note. I mean, really, I think there's sort of a little bit of a hierarchy. And so an email is great, certainly better than not doing anything. And I think a phone call, especially if you reach one of the legislative aides, is maybe just a notch better. But yeah, if you can go in person to the district office, make an appointment and sit with somebody, again, one of those aides, that has tremendous impact, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think all of that personal contact is what's making the difference for this campaign.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. All right, Jan. Well, gosh, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and filling us in. We've been speaking with Jan Creamer, again, of Animal Defenders International. One more time, the website is ad-international.org for all kinds of information about the work they do, various campaigns, investigations, etc. And again, a simple way to click on some things and reach, initially at least, your congressional representatives, and hopefully on the path to, in many cases, going to see them in person in their district office. So, Jan, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much, Duncan. A real pleasure.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks again.
Thank you.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Dr. Lincoln Parks, the retired veterinarian, who continues to build custom-made carts for paralyzed animals, as he has for more than 60 years. By the way, again, he is 92 at this point. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is Eddie Pepitone, who I have to say might have become one of my faves. Every time I see him, he really makes me laugh. Doesn't always translate fully to audio only. You really got to see this guy. But this comes close, I think. It's Eddie Pepitone with a piece called Dog Therapy. In today's comedy corner, on Talking Animals on WMNF.
But I've turned my dog into my shrink. I'm talking to her now as if she was my shrink because I'm bored to tears with my real shrink. You know what I mean? We understand each other. I'm there to fill an hour. She gets some insurance money, whatever it is. But now I talk to my dog like she's my shrink. I'm saying to her, like, Charlotte, You don't think I have diabetes, do you? I mean, they've got blood work all the time. Those centrifuges they use, a lot of them are suspect. And Charlotte, you don't think the cop saw me sideswipe that car in the shopping supermarket parking lot? I mean, the police would be here already, right? Charlotte, it's not too bad that I threaten people anonymously online, is it? Charlotte, I have enough money in my bank account, right? By the way, if Charlotte knew how much money I have in my bank account, instead of running and chasing balls, she'd just be in the apartment smoking cigarettes. She'd just be like going, great, I thought I landed on my feet here.
That was Eddie Pepitone with a piece called Dog Therapy, taken from his collection In Ruins. Now let's talk with Dr. Parks, the retired veterinarian who remains very active in his business of making custom-made carts for paralyzed animals, something he's been doing for more than 60 years. Let's welcome now Dr. Lincoln Parks to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Parks.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals.
Animals, it is.
Yeah. So, how's your day so far?
We're getting ready for a big shower.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so you're being affected by some of those crazy weather patterns, I guess, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I have people coming in with problems always.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of those at least more generally. First of all, I know this goes back a ways, but what prompted you to start making carts for animals, low those 60-some-odd years ago?
Well, I was in training for surgery at the Animal Medical Center in New York City. And I found that not all of your animals survive to walk. And people are not willing to give up their animals. And they didn't ask me. They told me, go out and find some way I can keep my animal happy. So I did. I was also teaching. And I put together a little cart from materials that we had for splinting and put some wheels on it. And the dachshund ran out the door, and I said, oh, I'm in trouble. And that was about 60 years ago, and there was just no one had tried to give mobility to these poor little animals, that all they wanted was to get from A to B, and that would make them happy, and indeed they did.
Yeah. So once you'd done, let's say, one or two of these, was it inevitable that you would just keep going?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, looking back, but I mean, at the time, did you ever imagine that you'd keep going for decades?
Well, it was so obvious that giving a small dog mobility, they go from depression to excitement, and they run out the door, and I guess maybe I was as excited as they were.
Yeah.
And I felt that there was a real need. And indeed, I was not making them. I am for a while now, but I maintained a shop for them. And when the animals came in and needed one, I had the shop either in my building or alongside somewhere. And we took care of them in that fashion for about 20 years. That we were the only guy on the street, but now there are quite a few, not more major companies. There are about six major companies.
Yeah, and so at your shop, what animals have gotten their own carts? dogs and cats, I think it's safe to say, but what are some other animals over the years that you've custom fit with these kind of decors?
Rabbits.
Okay.
Birds, we've put them in. And
oh, what kind of birds?
Larger birds, actually, chickens.
Yeah?
There are a lot of people out there that have a chicken as a pet, believe me.
Yeah, no, that much I knew, but I guess it's, I wouldn't have pictured necessarily immediately chickens with a cart.
Well, you make a round nest-like material and pad it, and it works. And spread the wheels out far enough to maintain stability, and then align it the wheels so that they are hard to move, and away they go.
Yeah. Now, over all these years, have you ever been stumped by an animal that was paralyzed, but you just couldn't quite figure out how to make it work to create the cart?
No.
Okay. That's a crazy question on my part. I take it back. I apologize, Dr. Parks.
No, there's always a way.
Yeah.
Where there's a will, there's a way, they say, you know?
Yeah. So it's just a big sort of problem solving, like sort of a puzzle based on whichever animal it is.
It's a pretty basic situation. The wheels are, as long as they turn and you keep the animal comfortable, that's all they want.
Yeah.
And it's not that difficult, really.
Yeah. And how long does it typically take to make a cart?
Well, that's just one of my problems right now. It depends on how you approach the problem. Once you standardize what you think is a good product and it's working, you have the parts made, and then you can make them in hours.
Mm.
But if you have to stop and make every part, no, that's not... You can't do it, not to make money anyway. I still don't make any money, but the point is you have the parts made and just assembled.
Yeah.
And you have, but you're going through a range of weights and lengths and so on, but it's not that hard to pick a range of sizes and clamps and put together bars or flat material.
Yeah. Well, we have just maybe about a minute left, Dr. Parks, but when we spoke the other day, just to kind of arrange this interview, you'd mentioned that you'd come up with some new designs that you seem to be very excited about. I mean, how so? How are they new and different, or is it in this way you were just describing where there's easier to sort of create the parts in advance?
Well, yes. There's a need for outside activity with wheels, but when you put a big dog, say, in a cart inside, or even a small cart with wheels, you have to do special things to make them work so they don't tear the house down and they don't get caught in everything going by.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm creating some products that are for smaller dogs primarily, and now I'm going to extend them for a large dog so that a 80-pound dog doesn't do very well in the house with a standard cart.
Yeah.
So we get them so that they're really lying down, but they can get around.
Great.
I can't go much further than that until I show what I have.
Yeah. Well, this all sounds very exciting. We are out of time at this point, Dr. Parks. But thank you very much for joining us on Talking Animals. And thank you for all the animals that you've helped over these 60-plus years.
That's, there are 100,000 at least.
Yeah. No, no,
myself.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, keep up the great work, and thank you again.
You bet.
Bye-bye
thank
now.
You. Bye-bye.
All right, that was Dr. Lincoln Parks again. Thanks to him for joining us. And coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Loray with Radioactivity, extending this four-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. At 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with yours truly actually subbing for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, it's time for Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, so please do not call in if you have won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. There will be a prize, a book from the Talking Animals Vault, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. If you can't name that tune, we'll take your guess off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Next week, my guest will be Sally Williams, founder of the Brody Fund, which helps families in a growing number of states pay for cancer treatments for their pets. I invite you to join me for that conversation. Also invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. Also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, Instagram, etc., all on TalkingAnimals.net. You can also subscribe to our newsletter there. Find out about guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals headquarters. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. As usual, we're closing out today's show. Well, we don't have time for anything more. It's Talking Animals, NPR.